welcome to Worlds Apart. American presidential elections have always been more about personalities than policy issues. And perhaps that made sense because the policies haven't differed that much from one administration to the next, at least in this century. But given that the status quo is increasingly hard to sustain, can 2024 indeed change how the U.S. public politics operates and who or what it takes for granted? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Wilmer Leon, an American political scientist. Mr. Leon, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for being available.
My pleasure. Thank you for the invitation.
Now, in your writing and in your interviews, you consistently make the argument that elections should be about policies and reflect, at least to some extent, the will of the constituents. But let me start by asking, which actual American elections in the past couple of decades delivered that? I mean, elections not as the political theater so that the powers that be or the American public at large can sustain this myth of democratic governance, but elections that genuinely try to execute the will of the people and put it into practice.
I would say the last election that I believe where we had substantive debate was probably the 2007 Barack Obama, John McCain election. And I say that because I think that started with the actual primary campaign between Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, because you didn't have an incumbent president running for reelection. You didn't have a sitting vice president running to become president. The field was wide open. And with that wide open field, that brought an awful lot of individuals, an awful lot of ideas to the forefront. And so I would have to say it was the 2007 Barack Obama, and then also the 2012 Obama Mitt Romney campaign was probably another example. That was probably the last one.
Can I ask you here, because President Obama was a truly inspirational figure, at least in the beginning. I mean, to all of us, to people around the world. And I remember that campaign being indeed very vibrant. I think he was also very novel in the way how his campaign reached out to people, not only the Black communities, but also communities, across many demographics. But did President Obama actually deliver what he promised? Because you're talking about the debate, but as far as I remember, the Libyan campaign and many of the promises, even on the domestic front, it was rather disappointing, given the enthusiasm in the beginning.
Oh, absolutely. The whole idea of hope and change. We had the Latino community with Si Se Puede, yes, we can. That was the mantra. But no, did he deliver on the progressive agenda that he ran on? No, he did not. Did he deliver on healthcare reform? No, he did not. Tax cuts? No, he did not. And in term from a foreign policy perspective, I believe that he was really put forward in order to promote a neoliberal agenda that seemed accessible or acceptable because it was an African American that was promoting it.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think put forward is the key phrase here. Let's talk about the personalities who are being put forward in this campaign. And nominally, there is still a race between the Republicans and the Democrats, even though the Republican nominee is at loggerheads with some establishment of his party, while the Democratic candidate didn't seem to excite the establishment of her party only a few months ago. Is it now a contest of personalities, of agendas, lesser evils, or perhaps something else?
It's a combination of personality, and there's also the argument, particularly from the left, that it's the lesser of two evils. There are many Harris supporters that will make the point anybody but Trump. And so that is a mantra, a very strong mantra from the left. Even as you try to engage in debate about the lack of policy articulation by Vice President Harris, people will nod and nod, and then they'll smile and say, yeah, but she's not Donald Trump. So I believe it's a matter of personality versus a personality and the lesser of two evils. There's very, very, very little policy being articulated.
Yeah, I agree with the lesser of the two evil tactic. And I think it was very vividly demonstrated in the latest debate in which the candidates spent more effort disparaging their opponent or describing how they would save the country from an impending disaster than putting forth a novel or in some way positive agenda. Does the American system, the way it's structured, does it still allow for genuine grassroots-driven change?
I'm going to differentiate between the way it's structured versus the way it's financed, because I don't believe that the structure, even though it is a duopoly, that still could allow for substantive debate on serious issues that are not only impacting the United States domestically, but also are having a dramatic impact on foreign policy. But when you look at how the campaigns are financed and the fact that the military industrial complex or the Mickey Mat, as Ray McGovern refers to it, is funding both sides of the argument, that's one of the reasons why you have very, very little debate. And here's a quick example. Probably April of this year, in the New York Times, there was an article by AIPAC saying that they were going to spend $100 million to unseat as many progressive Democrats as they could get their hands on. And it all had to do with their perception of how these individuals felt about policy as it relates to occupied Palestine. So here you have Democrats that are afraid to challenge genocide simply because of how much money is being dumped into their campaigns, into their coffers, into their pockets by an outside entity such as AIPAC.
Now, Mr. Leon, you wrote recently that it's imperative that the Democratic Party not only change the messenger, but also change the message, and that Harris's run for power is based on policy rather than the fear of another Trump's presidency. But isn't the problem with the Democrats that they don't actually want the system to change? They want to keep an elitist hold on power under the slogans of democracy. Is it really so much about the message or the messenger as opposed to what's done with them after the votes are counted?
The point you're making is validation of the point that I just made. They're funded by the same interests. I remember back in 2020, I think his name is James Calhoun. He was the CEO of Boeing. And he was asked during the Biden-Trump campaign, which candidate did Boeing prefer, Biden or Trump? And James Calhoun said, doesn't matter to Boeing, because both candidates understand what Boeing does. Both candidates understand the niche or the need that Boeing fills, and they're going to do just fine. So what he was saying was, we know that Boeing makes aircraft parts and fighter planes, and along with Lockheed Martin and the others. And so he's saying the war, basically what I took away from that was the war is going to continue. They're still going to get paid. It doesn't matter who's in the White House. So that's the point about it's a matter of funding. The system, yes, needs to be changed. But within the established system, there could be space if a candidate had guts to stand up and champion the proper issues. Unfortunately, it's the financing that is corrupting the system.
Well, the way I see it, both candidates right now are championing some issues. For example, Donald Trump is speaking about immigration, and he may be very unorthodox in the way he conducts his argument. But still, I mean, he seems to be genuine, at least standing up for the things that he believes. Now, Kamala Harris, I think she is a little bit artificial, but again, taking from the latest debate when she spoke on women's issues, I thought she was sincere. So they seem to bring some genuine concerns to the table. You cannot accuse them of insincerity completely, and yet it seems that that genuine approach is fading away once the ballot stations are closed. Why is that?
Well, there's a difference between articulating issues and articulating policy. And so, and the immigration issue is a perfect example. Building a wall, remember, Donald Trump told us we're going to build the wall and Mexico's going to fund it. Well, where's the wall and where's the peso? It hasn't found its way into American accounts. And when you talk about the immigration, it's not a matter of just looking at the number of people that are at the border. You have to ask yourself, why are they there? And the people are at the border because American foreign policy towards Guatemala, American foreign policy towards Mexico, American foreign policy towards Colombia, towards Haiti, has decimated the economies in these countries, forcing those people to leave their homes and come to the United States. Quick example, Chiquita Brands, the banana company, was just convicted of sponsoring death squads in Colombia. And now is having, and this came out in a federal court in Florida. I haven't heard Donald Trump talk about that. I haven't heard Kamala Harris talk about that. Kamala Harris can wring her hands and get all disgusted and frustrated and flustered because Donald Trump is making racist tropes and diatribes about Haitians eating animals in Springfield, Ohio, as she should, because that's just racist, deplorable, and disgusting. But then why is she backing the United States policy towards reinvading Haiti and paying Kenya to do it? That's incredibly hypocritical and incredibly inconsistent. So you can talk about, oh, it's atrocious that Donald Trump is talking these racist tropes about Haitians, which is true. But why are the Haitians in Springfield, Ohio, in the first place? It's because she goes to CARICOM trying to convince the Caribbean nations to be the black face on American foreign policy and imperialism as they try to reinvade Haiti.
The Democratic Party for a very long time wanted to have anybody on their ticket but straight white men. And these days they seem to have that person who ticks all the, seemingly ticks all the diversity boxes. Why do you think Kamala Harris's reception, both within the party's establishment and seemingly, according to the polls, within the larger base, is not so enthusiastic? Do you think people perhaps are suspecting that having a particularly colored face is not enough to run a country?
Well, it never has been, and it never will be, because it's not about the politics of phenotype. It's about the politics of policy. And so when we were heading into electoral season, say starting in June, Joe Biden was still on the ticket. And there were a lot of people in this country, if you go back and look at the primaries in Michigan and look at the primaries in Wisconsin and Minnesota, you had an unprecedented number of dual haters, people that were voting as uncommitted because they didn't want either of the candidates. And so when Joe Biden withdrew from the election, that now provided some space for another Democrat to fill the void. But a lot of people, A, didn't like the fact that she was anointed instead of elected. There was no primary process promoting Kamala Harris to that position. Then you get to the convention, the Democrats' convention, which I attended, no discussion of policy. And you had a lot of people that were protesting the Gaza policy, that their protests fell upon deaf ears. Uh-huh. So you still have a number of people within the body politic that aren't liking what they're hearing because they're not hearing anything other than blah, 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 blah.
Okay, well, Mr. Leon, we have our own process here, and that process includes taking a very short break. We will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
Now, there aren't many places in the world where you can say you're on the divide between two oceans. And although you might not think it, one of them is here in Russia's northern Arkhangelsk region in the Kinozora National Park. And today, we're not going to let the weather stop us from taking a deep dive into its rich ecosystem.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Wilmer Leon, an American political scientist. Mr. Leon, just before the break, we started discussing the particulars of the 2024 campaign and how color, gender, or any other superficial characteristics shouldn't matter as much as, you know, substantive policy discussion. And yet, I think the judging from what I read in the American media, the Democratic establishment, the Democratic Party, is still counting on the black vote as one of their main support groups. Do you think they will get it this year?
Yes, will they get it to the degree that it's needed to beat the MAGA base? I'm not sure, but I do know that we are still 40 some odd days away from the election, and a lot of things can happen between now and the 5th of November. But as I look at the numbers now, and as I listen to a lot of the dialogue and the discussion within the African-American community, yes, once again, the African-American community will turn out and support the candidate. And the real issue, in fact, John Jeter, a brilliant journalist, has a piece out called How the Dems Use Performative Blackness to Appeal to the African-American Community. That's not the exact title, but that's close enough. And his point is, once again, the Democrats are turning to the black community, begging, cajoling, we need you, we need you, we have to defeat Donald Trump, but they're not offering any substantive policy to encourage us to support them. It's a matter of the vice president went to a historically black college. She is a member of the Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority Incorporated, and she dances pretty well. That's pretty much what we're getting.
Now, you also wrote a brilliant piece, I thought, on the analysis of the 2016 campaign and why Hillary Clinton lost to Donald Trump at that time. I think you also made in that piece a very poignant observation countering the mainstream framing that Clinton apparently lost because the black voters didn't turn out in large numbers. And the reason the turnout was so low was because of supposedly post-Obama apathy. What's your issue with this kind of framing?
That is wrong, and that is not supported by the data, and that it fails to take into account the first important fact, and that is Hillary Clinton ran a lousy campaign. She didn't campaign, for example, she didn't campaign in Michigan. Democrats can't win the White House. For those that don't know, it's not only a matter of the popular vote, they have to go through what's called the Electoral College. And you have to get 270 votes in the Electoral College in order to become president. A Democrat cannot get to 270 without Michigan. She didn't campaign in Michigan. She took Michigan for granted. And she waited till the very end of the campaign to campaign in Pennsylvania. She ran a lousy campaign. Start there before you then turn and try to blame African Americans for not turning out. And by the way, the Democrats started also making that same argument in August about 2024, blaming Black men. Why do Black men not like Kamala Harris? No data to support the narrative, but they just were preparing the country in case Vice President Harris loses. They're preparing the country to make the same argument again. African Americans are disillusioned. African Americans are lazy. They're apathetic, and they didn't turn out. What are you giving the community to vote for, other than she's not Donald Trump?
I want to quote you here because you wrote that African Americans are as political as the rest of the country, and there are real and substantive political interests that motivate the community. It's almost like saying African American are people too, you know? Isn't that a presumption of the Black vote racist at its core?
There's no question. But unfortunately, there are too many African Americans that aren't demanding anything of the candidate. So we in the African American community create part of this problem for ourselves because we go along with the dominant narrative. We're not demanding that they pass another Voting Rights Act. We're not demanding that they pass the John Lewis Policing Act. We're not demanding that Kamala Harris address health disparities and wealth disparities and education disparities. We're not making any demands on her. So then when she gets elected, or if she gets elected and then doesn't deliver, she'll give the same answer that former President Obama gave when he was asked, why didn't you do more for the Black community? The answer he gave, y'all didn't demand anything.
Now, let me ask you about the Republicans, too, because according to Gallup, more American voters now identify with the GOP as the party that is better equipped to address the most important, the most pressing American problems like economy, immigration, government, inflation. But it is pretty clear that the party is not unified either. And I wonder if you take these numbers as an expression of genuine support for the Republicans, or is it yet another example of the lesser of the two evils, that they're sort of supporting what they have for the lack of anything better?
Well, I think it really has more to do with the narratives that are being presented and supported by mainstream American media, because the Washington Post, the New York Times, MSNBC, CNN, they are very, very selective in the data and the numbers that they present in order to support a particular narrative. And from what I have been reading from those periodicals and what I have been listening to from those television programs, they have already made the determination that they're no longer going to be journalists. They're going to be scribes for the elite. And so they're already basically laying the precedent or predicate that Donald Trump shouldn't be reelected and Kamala Harris is the next best thing to slice cheese. And so it's hard for me to trust the polling data, because the information that those that are being polled is skewed dramatically.
Mm-hmm. In Trump's first run for office, this is my personal opinion, let me know if you disagree, I think it was characterized by so much inner or internal sabotage, in part because he didn't have the Republican establishment behind him. Do you think this time around, if he manages to secure the White House, do you think the act of the Republican establishment would be any better? Do you think they would value this opportunity as their own win, or would they see it as, yes, Trump got into the office again, we have to wait and see for another 4 years?
I think when you talk about Republican establishment, if you're talking about the Mitch McConnells of the world and the Dick Cheneys of the world, they, I believe, are dreadfully fearful of Donald Trump being reelected. Hence, Dick Cheney supporting Kamala Harris. I for as much as he loves to clamor and run around behind Donald Trump, Lindsey Graham, I think, is dreadfully afraid of Donald Trump because the elite believe, the old guard see this as the last-ditch effort to save the party that they have known and loved. They see a fundamental shift with this MAGA movement that they cannot control. Mm-hmm. Even though they allowed it to develop, you can go all the way back to the Tea Party and Tom Tancredo back in 2006, 2007. Donald Trump is an outgrowth of that. He's the Frankenstein monster that they allowed to develop with through the Tea Party and Tom Tancredo, we want our country back, and all those racist tropes and eugenic tropes that they factored into the politics. And they see this as a last ditch effort to get, because now they see the Frankenstein monster is ravaging the village.
Mr. Leon, you mentioned a moment ago, and you often mentioned that in your articles, that voters too need to articulate a vision and be committed to holding elected politicians accountable for delivering and not delivering practical change. And that's a very tricky issue because, again, in my view, the American system is structured in a way that incentivizes both exorbitant, unrealistic promises and very active non-doing. Just how can voters hold the political powers, not just the political personalities, but political powers accountable for their actions and for their inaction?
Well, the first thing is it starts at the grassroots level. And I truly believe that all politics is local. So it's a matter of controlling your city councils, controlling your school boards, even controlling your neighborhood watch committees, and starting your politics there and working your way up through the system so that those at the top understand that those at the bottom are paying attention. And by putting your money where your mouth is, by funding candidates, progressive candidates that truly believe we need to get out of Ukraine, that we can't fund genocide in Gaza, that we should not be starting a fight with China over Taiwan. You've got to be putting your money where your mouths are, attending political rallies, screaming and yelling when the Kamala Harris's come out and say Israel has the right to defend itself, even though we know it based on international law, that's just flat out wrong. But we can't just go along to get along, and we cannot just sit idly by and say, well, we can't make waves now. We have to be quiet. We'll deal with these real issues later. No, the later is now.
Well, I think this is actually one of the best aspects of the American system, this grassroots organization. And I think many countries, including mine, by the way, are taking example in that, because this is actually the only true way of building a community in which you belong and where you can actually affect change. So thank you for ending this discussion on a somewhat inspiring note. I really appreciate that.
My pleasure. Thank you for the invitation. Call me anytime.
Thank you. And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again on Worlds Apart.